I do this for my culture, 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 culture.
Peace and welcome back to For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with us for the second hour. Tonight, folks, we have a very, very special guest that has joined us live in the studio. And we're going to have some good time to talk to our guest. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public School System, Dr. Sonia Santelices, and we're so happy that she has taken time out of her busy schedule to talk to us. But more importantly, she will be answering your questions. Now, in a few moments, we will be opening up the phone lines to give you a chance to chime in, to share your thoughts, your questions about anything related to the school system. And then more importantly, try to find some, to get some understanding and some resolution. We're going to ask that all of your calls, for those who are planning to call in, to be short, sweet, and to the point, we'll hold you at a one-minute timetable, so that way we can accommodate all of our calls. So we want to first welcome back to the airways of WEAA and, of course, to For the Culture, Dr. Sonia Santelices. Good evening, ma'am. How are you, Doc?
Good evening. It's great to be back.
Good. It's good to hear you from you and see you again. We wanted to make sure that you got to good footing because you got to kind of get through the first, I guess, sort of kind of first week of school.
Yeah.
So how was the first week of school so far?
So I think the great thing being out in schools, both on the first day and the first week, was just the number of classrooms where kids were already engaged in teaching and learning. Teachers were already forming relationships. We really had a great week of school. You know, unfortunately, we had one hot day that week, which meant we had to dismiss some schools. But overall, I have to say we did a great job in terms of staff, really welcoming young people back. We had young people entering more. We had an additional two 21st century schools, which was exciting, seeing young people see those spaces and really staff being really excited to maximize the spaces, even some of our high school students in the new Reach building. And you know how teenagers can be. They don't really like to show a whole lot of emotion, but they had some when they were walking in the new school. So I think we're off to a good start. We have five more 21st century schools coming online, but I think the bottom line was teaching and learning was happening starting the first day, and overall we had a good start.
Good start.
Yeah.
So how can, now folks are wondering, Dr. Santelices, about what happened with the air conditioning situation.
Mm-hmm.
We know that this is the second year where it has really disrupted the flow of schools. There were some reports that said as many as 40 schools were impacted. Then others, I've read a statement from the governor. He said there was 57 schools. How many schools, first and foremost, were impacted by this situation with the the HVAC system?
Yeah, so it was about 57, but it was a combination, Faraji, of schools that we knew had no air conditioning that are part of our air conditioning plan in terms of using the limited capital dollars we have to make sure we're adding every year. But some of those schools were schools that actually have air conditioning, but that needed to be repaired. So the combination of both of those. This year, we added an additional five schools that have what we call VCU units, which are not just air conditioning, but provide air conditioning and heat, because as the public knows, that's also a challenge when the weather changes. But we went according to plan in terms of where we said we would have installation of air conditioning. We have it. The other piece that we heard loud and clear from families was they wanted clearer notification. They wanted to make sure that their young people were not being held in stifling conditions. And so this year, as in last year, when the temperatures got to a certain degree, we had to make the call. And
that temperature is usually about, what, 85?
Yes.
85 degrees.
That's right. So once we had a critical mass of classrooms that were reaching 85, and actually some reached it more slowly than others, that's when we made the call to cancel school, to release school early.
So how does this happen? How does the, you know, because you mentioned the plan, and I know that there was a plan that was, there was an air conditioning plan that the school system did. Of course, it was you, former Mayor Catherine Pugh, and many others that were part of this back in January of 2017. According to this plan, it was about $30 million that was dedicated to putting what the, well, you the VCUs, but the vertical package units, that's which you guys termed it, the VPUs, as part of this plan. You had identified many schools that needed like a total upgrade.
That's right.
Versus those who just needed some minor upgrades. But there was $30 million. But we're still at a situation, though, Doc, where folks are saying, you know, school was disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And that throughout the school day, you know, you had all of these children. Of course, that just creates a domino effect. How do we still get there? How does this happen? Is it a facilities thing? Is it a funding thing? Is it just not having enough manpower to make sure that these units are in place at the very beginning of the school year, so that way during the course of the year it doesn't fall to the wayside? Can you give us some context? Because I'm trying to wrap my mind around it.
Sure. And a lot of the context, Faraji, has not changed in the sense that we do not have the funding, the capital funding,
okay,
to be able to responsibly put in air conditioning or the VPU units in every single school. We have a plan to do that. We actually had outside, because we wanted an outside pair of eyes to look at our systems to say, is there something we're not taking into account? We have an ad hoc advisory council of folks within this sphere. So we had, you know, the CEO of Merit Properties. We had representation from Seawall Development and even, quite frankly, leadership at Port Covington, who all came in, looked at our plan relative to our dollars, and actually said to us, we're surprised you can do what you can do with the limited funding that you have and the age of the buildings. And so what we're seeing is actually the result of continued underfunding. And so what happens is we do have a plan in place. We do have outside eyes looking at us. So, you know, when folks want to say there's no accountability, I would argue we have a higher level of accountability in terms of how we are using the public dollars. But that does not change the fact that over a series of years, and given the small amount of dollars relative to other jurisdictions, you know, in terms of locally, you look at Baltimore County. Baltimore County forward funded. They
right.
took from their county dollars to ensure a speedier installation of air conditioning in a large number of their schools. We don't have that level of local funding coming into our capital budget.
Why
to
don't
do that. Well, and I think that's one of the things that you heard the city council asking in the spring budget forums. I think, you know, our city has to make a decision about how much, you know, is going to be the contribution. And I think, you know, we heard at our budget forum the city council asking some of those questions. And then I think some of it is coming from what are the decisions that have been made historically over time about what the state contribution is. And that is a lot of what the ACLU and others have been pointing out for quite a long time, long before I was CEO. I think what we have now is just that, you know, that convergence of that underinvestment. But we have actually streamlined our systems. We've had, again, industry experts come in, review those systems, and tell us that, we have actually improved in terms of our maintenance, in terms of making sure systems are online. But of course, as parents, you know, what parents know is their young people, if you're one of those students in a school, one of the 51 schools that still do not have air conditioning, you are, you know, clearly not satisfied, nor should you. But I think what's important for the public to know is we are making progress. We had five additional schools where the units were in place. We'll have an additional 7 to 10 that we're working on this year during the school year to put those in place. Mm-hmm. I went to one of the schools and I asked young people, is this different? And they said, absolutely. It feels better. But it takes money to put those units in. It's not just existing in our budget. And if we compare what Baltimore City has in terms of dollars to get this work done, mm-hmm. compared to other jurisdictions, it's not just about management. And we've had a number of outside institutions tell us that, and who have done that analysis, whether it's private industry people or folks who know school funding.
But how do we get it out of a space, Dr. Santelices, from making this become a political issue, a political mm-hmm. football issue? Mm-hmm. Because as much as you're saying that there's not enough funding, the governor have said that the school district is the third largest funded district in the state. But on the flip side, some other educational consultants, one by the name of Jess Gardner, she mm-hmm. mentioned mm-hmm. that, you know, that number, that context is inaccurate.
That's right.
That you know, Baltimore City, because of the fact of cost per pupil, we got to take in the fact of poverty. We got to take in the fact and some of the other socioeconomic factors that exist in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. That is not an accurate account. So in the midst of all of this talk about money, funding, I know the Caring Commission has been talking about this. Mm-hmm. How do folks on the ground, the parents and the students and the teachers and the staff, how do they make sense of it all? Because at the end of the day, the schools are still hot. At the end of the day, the schools are closing. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it still looks like the system is not working. It's still like the system is falling apart.
Well, I wouldn't say the system's falling apart.
Okay.
What I would point to is, one, we've done a better job communicating consistently across the board. We didn't have those systems in place. That was one of the things families and parents asked from us.
Right.
That we would do a better job at communicating. And so we have worked on that and we have improved. That doesn't mean we don't have other places we can, but the fact that we have a place for families to go to know when their young people are going to be released, when temperatures reach a particular level, that is true. And I think that we've improved on that. I think that we are showing, I know that we are showing that when we have the funds released, we are dedicating those funds to ensuring that they go into improving the climate conditions of buildings.
So how much money, for example, from your vantage point, how much extra money would the system need in order for these schools to be covered and for us not to be robbing Peter to pay Paul?
Well, what I will say is this, Faraji, is that we're talking about air conditioning now.
Right.
We could be having a conversation about heating. Right.
Yep.
And then, you know, people say, well, why don't you just go put window units in? Right. You know, I got a window unit in my window. Why not just put them in all the other windows? Well, if we already know mm-hmm. from industry experts that doesn't make sense, that's not a good investment in public dollars, why would we go spend, you know, $10 million to go just get window units when we know that is not a long-term solution? It's not the best solution. So what we are working to do is to make sure that we have a plan, that we can communicate that plan. The expenses go up the longer we have, but the bottom line is we are tracking. When we've said that we're going to put air conditioning in and we submit a plan, what we've done is said, look, we're open to industry standards. And I guess, Faraji, you know, one of the things that we're committed to do, that I'm committed to do, is continuing to make sure that every year, and we have a list on our website of schools that we know will come online. And if we were to get additional money for both the heating and the, you know, for the HVAC, we would be able to accelerate the pace at which we can get those systems into schools. But right now, with the dollars we have, the plan we have had many people say to us, the plan that you have makes sense. I mean, industry experts are not saying, wow, you guys are wasting over here. If politicians say that, you know, that's on the politician. But right. I go to industry experts in finance. I go to industry experts in buildings and construction. Mm-hmm. And what we are committed to is to keep families and the public updated as to which schools are coming online when with the new heating and air conditioning units. And where possible, we're working with our legislators. Hopefully we'll have another round of money. And frankly, we've won accolades with regards to industry folks who have seen how we've tightened our systems.
Are we expecting meteorologists have expecting there to be another kind of wave of heat for this upcoming week. Are we expecting any other closures or any other, given the fact that it's going to be in the high 80s or I think in the 90s this week?
So one of the commitments we have made to families is that when, and to staff, quite frankly, the commitment we've made is that when classrooms, a critical number of classrooms mm-hmm. exceed 85 degree temperatures, that we will not expect staff or students to be in those conditions. And that's what we're committed to, because I can't wave a wand tomorrow and come up with an extra $90 million to outfit, every remaining school with the VC units tomorrow. But what I can commit to is what families asked of us. And we actually got good feedback last school year. People weren't happy that their young people had to leave school early, but they preferred that to their young people being in conditions that were not conducive, to their well-being.
Folks, if you're just tuning in to For the Culture here on WEAA, I'm talking to the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools, Dr. Sonia Santelises. In a few moments, we'll be opening up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chime in as we've been talking a little bit about what's happening with this latest issue and challenge of heating and air conditioning in the schools, talking a little bit about funding as well. But we also got to talk about, Dr. Santelises, as you talked about funding. I want to shift gears on this piece around keeping qualified help in the classroom, teacher retention. That's a big thing for a lot of folks as well. This is the beginning of the school year. The Sun did a story about this issue for Baltimore County, how they're making an effort to hire 6,000 new teachers or to fill the holes of 6,000 new teachers. Give us an insight, if you could, about where we are in the city around teacher retention. Is there a large opening of openings for teachers right now for Baltimore City Public Schools?
No, I will say, actually, one of the things we're very proud of because of the work that school leaders have done, the work that our human capital office has done, actually, we had the lowest number of first-day vacancies in city schools since we've actually been tracking that over a decade. So we actually made great progress this year in that we have, some years we've had as many as 200 to 300 vacancies mm-hmm. first mm-hmm. day. We had less than 100 for the first time in, like I said, over a decade. Mm. And so we're making progress there. We have, because of the work that our Black teacher retention work group has done, we are really proud to say that we have retained 85% of our Black teachers, which is the highest it has been mm-hmm. In a number of years. We are also, frankly, really excited that what we are seeing is our highly effective principals and teachers, those that are rated highly effective, are staying with us for teachers at a rate of 90 to 94%. And our principals that are rated highly effective are staying with us 100%. We've had 100%. So what that means is we're not only retaining more teachers, mm-hmm. we're not only attracting more teachers, but we're actually doing a good job at keeping teachers. And for the first time in Baltimore City, again, at least since we've been tracking it, which is over a decade. For the first time, out of our new teachers, the majority of the new teachers we hired were Black teachers. And we, again, I really want to credit the work of the Black Teacher Retention Group that did a phenomenal job really informing practice. We are adopting just about all, if not all, of their recommendations, but we actually are seeing movement.
Yeah.
We are seeing in schools, one, the fact that we've been tracking teacher churn. We know that schools that have high churn of teachers leave young people vulnerable to that. So, and so we have, you know, we have spotlighted some schools where we need to go deeply with this, but we are also having deeper conversations with school administrators about that. So we're actually doing some great work on that.
How has the change of leadership for the teachers union, now being led by Ms. Diamante Brown, how has that change of leadership impacted, or what is the teachers union's role going to be to ensure that teacher retention and principal retention stay high?
Well, I think one of the things that we have seen is in a lot of these discussions, the current leadership within the BTU has had members even before the election was finalized who have been involved in this work. And I will say, that Ms. Diamante Brown has been more than, willing to be part of these conversations. We've had union leadership that has been on the table, and they'll continue to play a vital role, as kind of the official, not just bargaining, but the representative of teachers. And then we have teacher leaders who, frankly, are not necessarily in union leadership, but who are also leading from their classroom space. And so we look forward to that partnership. We will continue to work with them. And it's only been a couple of months,
right,
but they have stepped up and they're part of this work. And for a lot of them, they started even before they were officially part of the new union leadership.
Folks, we're going to take a quick pause, Dr. Sandalisa. When we get back, I'm going to open up the phone lines to hear what you have to say. What questions that you may have, concerns that you may have, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. We're going to be talking to Tim, DeAndre, and LaVon, but I got a couple of more lines that are open. So, folks, if you want to have any, if you have any questions or concerns for the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools, Dr. Sonia Santalisa, definitely give us a call right now at 410-319-8888. Stay riding with me. All of that is coming up in the final 30 of For the Culture right here on WEAA 88.9 FM. Absolutely the voice of the community. We'll be right back.
I do this for my culture, 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 culture.
Welcome back to For the Culture right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM. All right, folks, we are talking to Dr. Sonia Santalisa, the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. Time for you to ask your questions to the CEO. We ask that you keep your comments short, sweet, and to the point, and down to about a minute. We will cut you off because we have a lot of calls that are coming in. Let's go back now to the phone line, see what you have to say. 410-319-8888. DeAndre, kicking in from East Baltimore. What's your question?
Hey, what's up? How you doing?
I'm good.
Well, my question is, as far as dealing with the vocational high schools, I noticed that the shops in our high schools and vocational skills have waned, and it's not a lot of, like, take for instance, like Baltimore City, they have a lot of pipe bursts in the city. Well, pipe lay or pipe laying skill isn't really like a higher type of, it's a skill that can be taught in our high schools, in our vocational schools, and then we'll actually have certified pipe layers or pipe trainees that actually come out and start doing the work of the city and start already being ready to work and you know, laying the pipe in the city and actually, you know, help rebuilding the city. So, you know, I just want to know why, you know, we don't use our school system as also to foster up our workforce in the city, you know.
Gotcha.
Better skills, you know, like solar training, you know. That's,
gotcha.
You know, the STEM stuff, you know, why isn't more STEM classes or more STEM programs in Baltimore City that's actually geared to not sending people to college but come straight out of high school and actually be a part of the workforce right then and there.
There it is. Thank you. So, yeah. Hey, DeAndre, I got to stop you right there. I appreciate you, brother.
Dr. Yeah. Sandalisa. No, DeAndre, thank you for your call, because that is exactly what we have been focused on building up. One of the things that we have done over the last couple of years is we not only did a deep look at exactly what you're saying, where are the programs, but we have been investing in expanding those programs. So, for example, we're starting a new carpentry program over at Briscoe High School. We will have one future moving forward, Patterson. High School in their new building. If you go to Forest Park High School, which is a new 21st century building, we have different shops there because of exactly what DeAndre was saying. And what we are doing is building out programs that we know are tied to jobs. And so one of the things that we've done is a much deeper industry analysis so that we know we're matching young people to the programs where there is growth expansion and where they can earn a living wage. The other piece that we're doing, you know, which DeAndre hinted to and we know, is that not every young person is going to go straight to four-year college. But what we do know is in order to be certified, even in some of these career paths, you still have to, young people are still going to have to pass and some kind of entrance assessment. And so one of the things we're working on is aligning those entry assessments far tighter to the classes that young people are taking. But no, DeAndre is absolutely right. It's one of the reasons we're adding programs to do exactly what he's talking about, and even working with our own operations team to say, how do we as the school system better align the needs we have as a school system in actually helping young people get skills in some of these areas. So, like, we have a new HVAC program that we've begun, even, a phlebotomy program, and we're spreading them to more high schools. The problem was they were only located, say, at a Mervo or Carver, and we're proud of those programs, but what we heard from families and young people is we need those to be in every high school.
Absolutely.
So we're moving that out.
Absolutely. Let's go to Yolanda in Baltimore. Yolanda, thank you so much for checking in. What's your take?
Yes, I'm trying to figure out who's actually crazy. She's patting herself on the back for piss poor behavior. That says a lot about her. And first of all, I mean, second of all, a call being screened for her is totally ridiculous.
Okay. Well, we have to, it's not screened for her. It's just screened because we have a lot of folks that want to check in. What's your question, Yolanda?
Can I get to it? You cut me off.
Yes, ma'am.
Anyway, how much money do her administration and everybody else's administration get paid out of the school budget where these window units and these schools couldn't be fixed? If that's the case, she should have shut down all Baltimore City schools, had children homeschooled, go to wrecks until schools got fixed or something, because they get paid for every behind that sit in them seats. Now, she needs to just bow out gracefully. You failed us, ma'am, so you need to go.
All right. Thank you so much, Yolanda. We're at our 1 minute. Dr. Santelisa.
Yeah, so what I would say, you know, look, to Yolanda, is this. There are needs in this city that are connected to right? A lack of funding. And that's not going to change whether I sit in the seat or not. Number two, do we need to improve? Absolutely, we need to. And we have been doing that. Do we need to expand and increase, right, the rate at which we are getting schools ready, you know, in terms of climate and everything else, you know, with AC and heating? Absolutely. And there are more schools now than there were 2 or 3 years ago with new AC and new heating. It's what the 21st century, it's what the community mobilized around for 21st century schools. But to just say, right, that, okay, it's because it's waste. Well, you know, I want her to also know Baltimore City has the lowest percentage of our budget tied, right, with one other school district in this state for our administrative costs. So for people to say it's bloated in administration, that is not, it's just not borne out. We have cut Central. If you look at our presentation to city council, you will see that overwhelmingly school funds, public funds in Baltimore City go directly to schools and the support of schools. So I understand, and she is absolutely, I am accountable to families, but I will also say that we have to also grapple with some of the fundamental issues of things being laid to waste with underfunding over a period of time. But yes, do we need to improve? Absolutely. But we have more schools now that have better facilities in terms of upkeep and maintenance. If you talk to principals, we are becoming more responsive over the last 2 to 3 years. And no, I'm not patting myself on the back, but I am saying we are moving. But the full recognition of what it is going to take to get every young person in a 21st century school, we are going to have to reckon with the fact that we have over $2 to $3 billion worth of backlogged maintenance that needs to occur. And no magic wand is going to make that go away.
Mm. Tim, checking in from Baltimore. What's your question for Dr. Santelices, Tim?
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say my children just started public school this year at Edmondson. And I've noticed that the classes are overcrowded. And so at one point, my child can't even hear what the teacher's saying because the teacher has no control over the class.
Mm.
So that's kind of like a real issue for me because she can't learn in that kind of environment. So I just wanted to hear, what do you have any ideas for these classes that are overcrowded?
No.
Thank you so much for checking in, Tim.
No, thank you, Tim. And it is absolutely a question that a parent would ask and that I would ask. So I'd say a couple of things. One of the things that we do, Tim, is we look at the enrollment at the school level at about September 30 within the district to say, where do we have spaces within the schools where we might need additional staff, right? Mm-hmm. Where we might have had more young people show up than were predicted to show up. And so we call that budget adjustment. And so what happens around September, October is where we need to place additional staff and do some shifting, we will do that. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it is the principal's responsibility to make sure that teachers who are having challenges with classroom climate, and I think, you know, at least what I heard your other concern was just about the kind of learning environment that was going on and whether that particular teacher was able to support that. That's the role of the principals. That's one of the things that we're doing a deeper dive on is working with principals to say, okay, how are we better supporting teachers, as you noted, because you're right. Your child should be able to learn in an environment, right, that is conducive to learning. And if there is no, you know, if there's behavioral issues all the time and too many kids, then that's not going to happen. But so I'd say, one, we do a budget adjustment where we will be adding staff where we just didn't predict at the school level we'd have the number we would have. And then two, this is part of the work that we do with principals in the early months of school to say, okay, which teachers might need additional support in making sure that the climate in the classroom is conducive to learning. Because you're right, young people can't learn in chaos.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phone lines as we're talking to the CEO of Baltimore City School, Dr. Sonia Santelices. Let's go to LaVon in Baltimore. LaVon, what's your question on your take?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. And how are you, Doctor? I appreciate your job. It's amazing for the little that you have. one thing people need to do more of is pay attention to what's happening in Annapolis over the past 4 decades with the underfunding. Right now, ACLU is suing the state of Maryland because of underfunding, decades of underfunding. So the average age of our school buildings in Baltimore City is 42 years old. It's been 2013 since they had built a new school in our city. So the people are being asked to repair buildings that are so old, you can't even punch a nail in it without it falling apart. So it would be a waste of money to put new air conditioning system when they have to redo something with the electric. It wouldn't support a new system of the ages of systems that will be put in the building. So I hope people will pay attention to the masses this year to make sure that starting January that no more cuts will be made to Baltimore City. And the current commission also recognized the city being underfunded. That's a true reality that we have to deal with. We're being given a shortage of funds, but we expect to do the multiple of work that other jurisdictions have when their age building schools are 17 years old.
I got you,
so
LaVon.
We really need to do our part,
yes,
and
ma'am,
advocate for the schools.
All right, LaVon, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for checking in and sharing that insight with us. And I think, Dr. Santelisa, this is what you were alluding to in your remarks.
No, and LaVon, I want to thank you because you frankly said it far more directly. And that is that the issue that we have to mobilize around, you know, look, people can weigh in. Absolutely, the school system, we have work to do. Absolutely, we need to improve. But I agree with LaVon. If we miss as a community the overall challenge of funding, then we do not have our eye on the ball. And I think what LaVon was saying, and frankly, a very leadership, community leadership stance, is when is that demand going to be made? Or are we going to continue to listen to distract or political red meat statements like accountability, right? And is that distracting us from the real issue of systematic, documented underfunding over decades? This is not something that happened 3 years ago. This is something that has been happening over a period of time. LaVon is right. ACLU has documented, and she's right. That is exactly why they're suing the state.
Let's go to Fred in Baltimore. Fred, thank you for checking in. What's your question, your comment for Dr. Santelisa?
Well, first and foremost, let's go back to 2003 when she wasn't even here. And someone explained to half of the listeners what happened to the $57 million that Carmen Russo left the school system and misappropriated funds. She was able to leave and go to another state and even another country.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever barked about that money. People lost their jobs. That's $57 million that's gone. We haven't heard nothing about. We need strong leadership that's going to come in and say enough is enough. And then they brought in AAA, Dr. Alonzo. He made all these principals responsible. Now, principals should be responsible, but the principal can't tell a kid, mother, to get him to school or how to control these kids. And then when she's trying to discipline even some of her own teachers who don't want to do what they need to do, the higher-ups don't back the principals. So those things need to be addressed, because if you got parents that are, let's say, on drugs and they're not making their kids come to school, and we know the consensus of taking somewhere around September, October, she can tell you what date that is, where that allocates so much funds for kids, for the state to give money to the city for these particular kids. You got 50 kids at $10,000 a kid, that's $500,000 that the state, that the city is out of. And then these kids come to school, say October 1st, October the 2nd, they're infringing upon other kids' money who has been allocated. We don't have programs in place to bring these kids back to school. Some of these kids not in school, not because they just don't want to be, but because maybe they're behind in grade, and an eighth grade kid ain't gonna sit in a class with a fifth grader.
Right.
That's not gonna happen. We don't have these kind of programs in place, and if we do, tell me about it. But I want to know about the $57 million.
Yeah.
If she knows about it, and why are we still under, or are we still under Dr. Alonzo's program for these principals.
Hey, Fred, I got to let you go right there, brother. Great question, Dr. Santelisa.
Yeah, no, thank you, Fred, for the question. So one of the things in terms of that specific $57 million, no, that has not, you know, that's not something that I have delved into in terms of where that went. What we have tracked, though, is what the compounded impact of the underfunding is, which is where we just even in capital dollars, that's where we get the, you know, $2 to $3 billion.
Right.
I will say this to Fred as well, is one of the things we have done is made sure with regards to audits, made sure with regards to, you know, any questions about fiscal management,
mm-hmm.
that we have really worked to be diligent about following up on those so that we don't have those big gaps in funding or anything in terms of the management. So we have worked really hard on that and continue to. And then the third thing I would say is in terms of accountability for principals, we have made sure that we, one, are keeping some of the principal supervisors consistent, also providing principals with support. But at the end of the day, anybody who looks will note that there are some principals that are not where they were. And in a number of cases, it was because we needed more, faster, on behalf of families. And I have had parents come up who were upset when I have moved principals out originally and were upset with me, who have come back and said, we just want you to know, actually, the new principal, like, we feel as if our young people are getting a better education because of that. And so that is our responsibility. That's my responsibility to oversee that. And I think that's why when callers call into you or call in to some of my staff, we are really working to take it seriously, to follow up on this parental concern. So when a parent calls in and says, you know, my young person first week of school can't learn because of the environment and the climate, I'm already in my head saying, okay, who am I going to now follow up with? Because at the very basic level, you know, as he was saying, people need to know that there is accountability, yes, for me, but throughout the entire organization.
Absolutely. Let's go to Claudia. Claudia, thank you so much for checking in. You're talking to Dr. Santelisa. What's your question, Claudia?
Okay, my first question is, Governor Hogan, I was looking at his comment that he said. He said, matter of fact, he said Baltimore City schools need to be held accountable. And he was outraged and completely unacceptable, he said,
mm-hmm.
that we are the third highest funded large school system. So I have a problem with him saying it, because we keep hearing it's the funding. But this man is our governor saying this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable. So for him to say that, we got to be getting some money somewhere.
Right.
And then I wanted to know, for Project Baltimore, why haven't they redacted the paper to see from the Project Baltimore that was stated? I mean, we haven't even seen that paperwork from that.
Okay. Claudia, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for checking in. I know, Dr. Santelisa, you addressed some of the language that the governor used.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that. But let's talk about that piece around Project Baltimore as well.
Sure. No, and I would just say, look, it is always convenient to come up with a one-liner about what is, you know, a systematic issue. And that's, you know, so in terms of, I don't go by what somebody's knee-jerk comment is. I go by what is on paper, what you can actually follow and track.
Mm-hmm.
And with regards to the money, there are many people who have tracked the funding in Baltimore City. There are many people who are expert in finance, not just politicians,
mm-hmm.
who understand and have weighed in on the underfunding of Baltimore City Public Schools. So that's one. Number two, with regards to the Project Baltimore, we actually have been releasing those documents. We have been releasing the redacted documents. One of the things that has occurred is we have been in communication with their lawyers because of the volume of the requests that they asked for. When you have over 100,000 pages that you have to then go through each one and redact the names so that people's identities are protected, that takes time. We went to court because we felt like, to protect whistleblowers, we wanted to be able to redact more. The judge said no, and we're complying with the law. Now, how people represent that within the media for their own purpose is up to them, right? And I don't have control over that. But I will tell you, in terms of our communication with the judge, with their lawyers, with the legal team, we have documentation on that. And we are communicating what they spend on their show. I don't have control over that.
Mm. Let's go to William in Halethorpe. William, thank you so much for checking in. What's your question?
In place to protect these teachers from these students that want to go around swinging on them for no reason?
Good question.
And number two, are you going to have a sit down with Chris Papps personally to, because these questions that he's throwing out there, nobody seems to be giving him a straight answer. We would like the straight answers from you. I'll take my comment off there.
Hey, thank you so much, William. First, classroom safety.
Yeah, no, thank you, William, for the question. In terms of classroom safety, one of the things that we are doing this year, we got a grant from the state that we just found out was approved to do a job, begin putting some additional systems in place that we knew, you know, visitor protocols will be putting in place, metal detectors will be putting in place. But with regards to safety for staff, one of the things that we have heard over and over from all staff, whether it's teachers or, you know, our cafeteria support staff, is the need to have skills to be able to de-escalate conflict. And so one of the things we began investing in even last year is being able to train and give our staff more tools because, you know, overall, the majority of staff, you know, they know that these are young people. We have young people who are coming in, you know, with untreated, you know, mental health issues, but then also, you know, school climate. And one of the things that we've done that we've gotten, you know, a lot of positive feedback we will be expanding is kind of those de-escalation techniques. We also are working with our teachers and principals on how to build more, healthy school environments.
Yeah.
One of the things we know is that schools that have healthy environments have far less of those issues. And we also invested in making sure that every single school had a full-time social worker this year. So we, and we've gotten really good feedback from principals about that. They feel that having full-time social workers, not half-time or third-time, is really going to help put them in the place to identify some of those issues, be able to connect with families, connect young people and families to some of the mental health resources and, frankly, other resources that they need. So those are some ways that we're really going after that.
And I guess to the other part of the question was to have a conversation with Chris Papps of Project Baltimore. Is that something that you're interested in doing?
Yeah, I think with regards to that, I have had conversations. I'm answering the questions tonight when people call. And, you know, my piece is when there is a fair forum, I won't have my comments cut up and sliced and put, you know, in a round robin. When I have gone on other shows, we've made statements. I'm taking the questions here tonight, mm-hmm. and you see with no problem, mm-hmm. because it's an open forum,
mm-hmm.
You know, and so I feel like I can answer forthrightly. I'm not going to subject the system to dicing and slicing a video, dicing and slicing of responses so that it is convenient and you can put it in a way that you want it. Again, outside of that context, I have given answers. I have no problem. I've given them tonight. I've given them on other shows, and I'll continue to give them. But I'm not going to allow kind of things to be diced and sliced in irresponsible ways.
Absolutely. Let's go to Cazette out of Columbia. Cazette, thank you so much for checking in. What's your question for Dr. Santelises?
Good day. I hear often funding. Dr. Sonia, if you can just think a little bit with your heart, out of the political realm, mm-hmm. out the box thinking, are you open to maybe some of this funding issue that we can, as a community, volunteer mm-hmm. to cut the manpower? Like you order the parts for the HVAC and the people in the community help put them in or do some of the things that is needed to be done for Baltimore City Schools. Thank you so much.
Mm. Thank you so much, Cazette. That's an interesting one.
No, it is, Cazette. And I think one of the pieces that I would say is we already have, you know, to the credit of the Baltimore City community, a number of community members, ground level folks who are assisting with things every day. So whether it is you know, helping to put in a garden at the school, whether it is painting throughout, you know, the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to school. We had community members donating time. In that way, we had community members who were helping to ready spaces. We certainly could look into that. I think some of the challenges on installation, one of the things that we want to be able to do is, you know, also monitor local folks who get jobs through doing this work. So mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it's not possible. What I am saying is I think you're right. There are other areas where we've been creative, because mm-hmm. there are many in Baltimore City, in the Baltimore City community, who do reach out and who are helping schools. Is there a possible way to do this around some of the heating and HVAC? It's a great idea, and we should look into it. I do think that we have, you know, we just have to make sure that we are following kind of the public codes that we're responsible to follow.
Makes
or
sense.
Or
yeah.
we're going to have another story about how we didn't follow code. But
right.
no, I would say to Cazette, you're right, it's worth looking into, and we've done that in other areas, and we probably should continue to do that as well.
Dr. Santelizas, first and foremost, we want to thank you for your time tonight. What is the thing you want us to keep in mind as we go through it? I mean, the school system is going through, I would say, a period of transition and changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
From an old systems to new systems, not just in terms of the HVAC, but also more importantly, from the mindset, the sentiment, the direction that mm-hmm. the school system is going into. So what would you suggest or recommend on how we should look at going forward, at least for the next few months into this new school year? And what can folks expect over the next few months from your office to take the school system to another new and different and much more progressive place?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would love for the public to track is what are the experiences of young people. We actually are on a trajectory of growth with regard to student achievement, and we've only really started digging in. And so even in those early years, we're seeing gains in what students know. We are opening both, you know, the call are around career programming. Our young people and families look for the new programming, look for new and increased amounts of mental health and social emotional support at schools. We have wellness rooms that we're getting wonderful feedback from young people and faculty are making a difference. Look at the quality of the experiences in schools. Yes, we do have underfunding, but as one of the callers, I think it was Cazette, said, it's not just, we're not waiting for the funding. We're moving the teaching and learning mm-hmm. and experiences for young people and families now. I'm not getting paid to just sit and wait for funding to come in. And what we are seeing and what our families are telling us is that as we're moving in those areas, it is making a difference for our young people. It's why even with only 2 or 3 years at this work, we're seeing the trajectory of graduation rates increase. Student achievement is beginning an uptick. I think that's going to increase even more. And again, more spaces in schools for young people to be able to connect on who they are as people. So there's a lot going on beyond just what we talk about in terms of lack.
Right.
There's a lot in terms of resource. And I have community members and families coming up to me every day in their schools saying they're beginning to see the shift in focus. And yes, do we have a ways to go? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, it's families and young people in the city that we are all, including me, accountable for.
Are you scheduled to make any appearances in Annapolis this year?
Sure, because, you know, I get called to do that. And because we're going to be advocating.
Right.
I've been advocating from year one. We're going to continue to do that. That is part of my job as well. But what I love is our community advocates that are doing it as well. Because parents, teachers, principals, you have more credibility when it comes to asking for those things. And so we're going to continue to defend. We're going to continue to push. I'm not letting up on that. That continues to be a priority. But also the priority is using what we have better and in ways that actually support and increase options for our young people.
There it is, folks. Dr. Sonia Santelizas, the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. Dr. Santelizas, thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you, Faraji.
Thank you. Welcome. You're welcome. All right, folks, that's going to do it for us. I want to thank my fantastic production team. It's Mallory Pinker, Pierre, Alex Blanc, and Dre Day for making me sound so good. And, of course, we want to thank each and every one of you for being a part of the conversation. Check us out at weaa.org. Stay tuned. Up next is In the Groove with LaDon Black. As always, never be afraid to challenge what's wrong. Stand for what's right while being yourself in the process.
Amen.
I look forward to talking to you tomorrow as we all talk about the issue of banning the box with Mr. Nick Mosby. We'll talk about that issue. Stay riding with us. A whole lot is coming up in the next few minutes right here on your source for cool jazz and more. It's WEAA 88.9 FM. Absolutely the voice of the community. Remember, Baltimore, do more, but be exceptionally good for the culture. Peace.